The whip was as long as the full stretch of Rasfer's arms, and it tapered to the thickness of his little finger at the point. I had watched him whittling it himself, shaving off the coarse outer layer from the long strip of cured hide until the inner skin was exposed, periodically pausing to test the balance and the heft of it, cutting it through the air until it keened and whined like the desert wind through the canyons of the hills of Lot. It was the colour of amber, and Rasfer had polished it lovingly until it was smooth and translucent as glass, but so supple that he could bend it into a perfect arc between those bear-like paws. He had allowed the blood of 100 victims to dry upon it, and to dye the thin end of it to a lustrous patina that was aesthetically quite beautiful. Rasfer was an artist with this awful tool. He could flick out and leave on the tender thigh of a young girl only a crimson weal that never broke the skin, but stung as viciously as a scorpion, and left his victim writhing and weeping with the agony of it. Or with a dozen hissing strokes he could strip the skin and flesh from a man's back and leave his ribs and the crest of his spine exposed. He stood over me now and grinned as he flexed the long lash in his hands. Rasfer loved his work, and he hated me with all the force of his envy and the feelings of inferiority that my intelligence and looks and favour engendered in him. My Lord Intef stroked my naked back and sighed. "You are so wicked sometimes, my old darling. You try to deceive me, to whom you owe the deepest loyalty, nay, more than simple loyalty, to whom you owe your very existence." He sighed again. "Why do you force this unpleasantness upon me? You should know much better than to press the suit of that young jackanapes upon me. It was a ludicrous attempt, but I suppose that I understand why you made it. That childlike sense of compassion is one of your many weaknesses, and one day will probably be the cause of your complete downfall. However, at times I find it rather quaint and endearing, and I might readily have forgiven you for it, but I cannot overlook the fact that you have endangered the market value of the goods that I placed in your care." He twisted my head up so that my mouth was free to answer him. "For that you must be punished. Do you understand me?" "Yes, my lord," I whispered. But I rolled my eyes to watch the whip in Rasfer's hands. Once again my Lord Intef buried my face in his lap, and then he spoke to Rasfer above my head. "With all your cunning, Rasfer, do not break the skin, please. I do not want this delightfully smooth back marred permanently. 10 will do as a start. Count them aloud for us." I had watched 100 or more unfortunates undergo this punishment, some of them warriors and vaunted heroes. Not one of them was able to remain silent under the lash of Rasfer. In any event, it was the best not to do so, for he took silence as a personal challenge to his skill. I knew this well, having travelled this bitter road before. I was quite prepared to swallow any stupid pride and pay tribute to Rasfer's art in a loud voice. I filled my lungs in readiness. 1, grunted Rasfer, and the lash fluted. The way a woman later forgets the full pain of childbirth, I had forgotten the exquisite sting of it, and I screamed even louder than I had intended. "You are fortunate, my dear Taita," my Lord Intef murmured in my ear. "I had the priests of Osiris examine the goods last night. They are still intact." I squirmed in his lap, not only from the pain, but also at the thought of those lascivious old goats from the temple probing and prying into my little girl. Rasfer had his own little ritual, to draw out the punishment and to ensure that both he and his victim were able to savour the moment to the full. Between each stroke, he jogged in a small circle around the barazza, grunting exhortations and encouragement to himself, holding the whip at high port like a ceremonial sword. As he completed the circle, he was in position for the next stroke, and he raised the lash high. 2, he cried. And I shrieked again. One of Lostri's slave girls was waiting for me on the broad terrace of my quarters when I limped painfully up the steps from the garden. "My mistress bids you attend her immediately," she greeted me. "Tell her that I'm indisposed." I tried to avoid the summons, and shouting for one of the slave boys to dress my injuries, I hurried through into my chamber in an attempt to rid myself of the girl. I could not face Lostri's yet, for I dreaded having to report my failure, and having at last to make her face the reality and the impossibility of her love for Tanus. The black girl followed me, ogling the livid wheels across my back with delicious horror. Go and tell your mistress that I am injured, and that I cannot come to her, I snapped over my shoulder. She told me that you would try to wriggle out of it, but she told me also that I was to stay with you and see to it that you did not. You are insolent for a slave, I reprimanded her sternly, as the boy anointed my back with a healing salve of my own concoction. Yes, agreed the imp with a grin, but then so are you. And she dodged the half-hearted slap I aimed at her with ease. Lostries is much too soft with her handmaidens. Go and tell your mistress that I will come to her, I capitulated. She said I must wait and make sure you did. So I had an escort as I passed the guards at the gate of the harem. The guards were eunuchs like myself, but unlike me they were portly and androgynous. Despite their corpulence, or perhaps because of it, they were powerful men and fierce. However, I had used my influence to secure both of them this cosy sinecure, so they passed me through into the women's quarters with a respectful salute. The harem was not nearly as grand nor as comfortable as the quarters of the slave boys, and it was clear where my Lord Intef's real interest lay. It was a compound of mud-brick hutments surrounded by a high mud wall. The only gardens or decorations were those that Lostries and her maids had undertaken, with my assistance. The vizier's wives were too fat and lazy, and caught up in the scandals and intrigues of the harem, to exert themselves. Lostries' quarters were those closest to the main gate, surrounded by a pretty garden with a lily pond and songbirds twittering in cages, woven of split bamboo. The mud walls were decorated with bright murals of Nile scenes, of fish and birds and goddesses that I had helped her paint. Her slave girls were huddled in a subdued group at the doorway, and more than one of them had been weeping. Their faces were streaked with tears. I pushed my way past them into the cool, dark interior, and at once heard my mistress's sobs from the inner chamber. I hurried to her, ashamed that I had been so craven as to try to avoid my duty to her. She was lying face down on the low bed, her entire body shaking with the force of her grief. But she heard me enter, and whirled off the bed and rushed to me. "Oh, Taita, they are sending Tanus away! Pharaoh arrives in Karnak tomorrow, and my father will prevail upon him to order Tanus to take his squadron upriver to Elephantine and to the cataracts. Oh, Taita, it is 20 days' travel to the first cataract. I shall never see him again. I wish I were dead. I shall throw myself into the Nile and let the crocodiles devour me. I don't want to live without Tanus." All this in one rising wail of despair. "Softly, my child," I rocked her in my arms. "How do you know all these terrible things? They may never happen." "Oh, they will. Tanus has sent me a message. Kratos has a brother in my father's personal bodyguard. He heard my father discussing it with Rasfa. Somehow my father has found out about Tanus and me. He knows that we were in the temple of Hapi alone. Oh, Taita, my father sent the priests to examine me. Those filthy old men did horrid things to me. It hurts so, Taita." I hugged her gently. It is not too often that I have the opportunity to do so, but now she hugged me back with all her strength. Her thoughts turned from her own injuries to her lover. "I shall never see Tanus again," she cried. And I was reminded of how young she truly was, not much more than a child, vulnerable and lost in her grief. "My father will destroy him." "Even your father cannot touch Tanus," I tried to reassure her. "Tanus is a commander of a regiment of Pharaoh's own elite guard. He is the king's man. Tanus takes his orders only from Pharaoh, and he enjoys the full protection of the double crown of Egypt." I did not add that this was probably the only reason that her father had not already destroyed him, but went on gently, "While as for never seeing Tanus again, you will be playing opposite him in the pageant. I will make certain that there is a chance for the two of you to speak to each other between the acts." "My father will never let the pageant go on now." "He has no alternative, unless he is prepared to ruin my production and risk Pharaoh's displeasure, and you can be certain that he will never do that." "He will send Tanus away and have another actor play Horus," she sobbed. "There is no time to rehearse another actor. Tanus will play the god Horus. I will make that clear to my Lord Intef. You and Tanus will have a chance to talk. We will find a way out for the two of you." She gulped back her tears and looked up at me with complete trust. "Oh, Taita, I know that you'll find a way. You always do. She broke off suddenly, and her expression changed. Her hands moved over my back, exploring the rigid welts that Rasfer's whip had raised across it. I am sorry, mistress. I tried to put forward Tunnel's suit, as I promised you I would. And all this is the consequence of my stupidity. She stepped behind me and lifted the light linen tunic I had donned to hide my injuries, and she gasped. This is Rasfer's work? Oh, my poor dear Taita, why did you not warn me that this would happen, that my father was so violently opposed to Tunnels and to me? I was hard put not to gasp at the artless piece of effrontery, I who had pleaded and warned them, and in return been accused of disloyalty. I managed to hold my peace, however, although my back still throbbed abominably. At least my mistress's own misery was forgotten for the moment in her concern for my superficial injuries. She ordered me to sit on her bed and remove my tunic while she ministered to me, her genuine love and compassion making up for the lack of her medicinal skills. This distraction lifted her from the utter depths of her despair. Soon she was chattering away in her usually bullying fashion, making plans to thwart her father's wrath and to reunite herself with Tunnels. Some of these plans demonstrated her good common sense, while others, more far-fetched, merely pointed to her trusting youth and lack of knowledge and experience in the wicked ways of the world. "I shall play such a fine role of Isis in the pageant," she declared at one stage, "and I shall make myself so agreeable to Pharaoh that he will grant me any boon that I ask of him. Then I shall beg him for Tunnels as my husband, and he will say..." Here she mimicked the king's pompous ceremonial tone so cleverly that I was forced to grin. "And he will say, 'I declare the betrothal of Tunnels, Lord Harab, son of Pyanki, and of the Lady Lostri's daughter of Intef, and I raise my good servant Tunnels to the rank of great lion of Egypt and commander of all my armies. I further order that all the former estates of his father, the noble Pyanki, Lord Harab, be returned to him.'" Here she broke off in the middle of her ministrations to my wounds, and flung her arms around my neck. "It could happen like that, could it not, dear Taita? Please say that it could." "No natural man could resist you, mistress," I smiled at her nonsense. "Not even great Pharaoh himself." If I had known then how close my words would turn out to being the truth, I think I should have placed a live coal on my tongue before I spoke them. Her face was shining with hope once again. That was enough reward for me, and I donned my tunic again to bring to an end her too enthusiastic ministrations to my back. "But now, mistress, if you are to make a beautiful and irresistible Isis, you must get some rest." I had brought with me a potion of the powder of the sleeping flower, which is called the Red Chepen. The seeds of this precious flower had first been brought into this very Egypt by the trade caravans from a mountainous land somewhere far to the east. I now cultivated the red blooms in my garden, and when the petals were fallen, I scratched the seed carapace with a gold fork of 3 tines. Thick white milk flowed from these wounds, which I gathered and dried and treated in accordance with the formula I had evolved. The powder could induce sleep, conjure up strange dreams, or smooth out pain. "Stay with me a while, Taita," she murmured as she settled down on the bed, curled like a sleepy kitten. "Cuddle me to sleep like you did when I was a baby." She was a baby still, I thought, as I took her in my arms. "It will all turn out all right, won't it?" she whispered. "We will live happily ever after, just like they do in your stories. Won't we, Taita?" When she was asleep, I kissed her forehead softly and covered her with a fur rug before I stole from her chamber.